The Guardian.
Hello, I'm Tom Clark, and this is Politics Weekly. And for one night only, we are casting up our eyes from Westminster. When a Tunisian street vendor set himself on fire in protest against local officials, few would have predicted how the flames would spread. First, Tunisia's own president, Ben Ali, was forced onto a plane to Saudi. Then Hosni Mubarak was ejected from power in Cairo. Suddenly, there was revolution in the air too in Bahrain, Jordan, and most violently, Libya. After decades of cozying up to Arab autocracies, the West has been forced to re-examine its stance. European foreign ministers are about to meet for an emergency session, and some are talking up intervention in the form of a Libyan no-fly zone. To help me make sense of all of this and how London should respond, we are joined by a distinguished panel of guests. The Guardian's Middle East editor, Ian Black, and our columnist, Simon Jenkins, who's a reliable sceptic about Western meddling every time that it is proposed. And last but not least, we have Lord Mark Mallock Brown, the diplomat turned Foreign Office Minister in the Gordon Brown government. Now, Ian, first of all, I heard you say more than once in recent weeks that you've given up making predictions, but I'm going to chance my arm and just try and get you to predict one thing, which is, has this momentum for democracy, or do you think we're seeing a movement that could still falter and peter out?
It's hard to say whether it's unstoppable, but it's easy to say that what's happening in Libya now has certainly punctured the excitement and the expectations about what some people are calling an Arab Spring. Began in Tunisia, as you say, extraordinary events in Egypt, which was particularly important because of its size and weight, the largest of all Arab countries. And we saw the, not entirely, but fairly peaceful departure of a man who had been in power for 30 years. That was an extraordinary achievement. There have been ripples elsewhere. We saw trouble in Bahrain, a small Gulf state. But now in Libya, the Arab uprising has encountered a regime which is bitterly resisting the idea that it be swept away by the tide of history and the optimism that we've seen about the region. So while very significant things have already happened, what's happening in Tripoli, the Libyan capital, right now is hugely important, both obviously for that country, for North Africa and the rest of the Middle East, the entire Arab world, and it's also proving to be a difficult test for the international community in knowing how to respond. Intervention did not take place, was not required at any significant level in either of the two previous cases where Arab leaders stepped down. In Libya, it's proving a different matter. It's going to be a very testing case.
Well, Mark, let's pick up on that point about intervention there and whether something should be done. In your new book, you say that the idea that the West could hide behind national sovereignty, even in the late 20th century, seemed a sort of embarrassing and outmoded one. It's the 21st century now. Gaddafi is turning on at least parts of his own people. Should something be done?
Well, actually, the UN Security Council resolution that got adopted 10 days ago, you know, very unusually did cite this new doctrine of the responsibility to protect, that indeed a country's own sovereignty is not absolute, and that if a government turns against its own people and commits mass human rights abuses, the international community has a responsibility to do something about it. The question is what? And, you know, they did put in place potential prosecutions under the International Criminal Court, freezing of assets, all sorts of things which are actually rather far advanced by the standard of these packages, but appear to people at the moment to be frantically slow and insufficient against what we're all seeing on our TV screens, and hence this rush towards doing something more. And I don't rule out that over time a no-fly zone might be a good thing to do if the killing really turned against civilians in very large numbers. But, you know, frankly, no-fly zones have a pretty bad history of drawing in a further kind of on-the-ground involvement. They have a bad history of ending up being characterized as a Western engagement, not an international community sanction. And so the politics, as well as the military side of these things, is very difficult. And at the moment, I think it would look like a slightly kind of frantic rush and would certainly look as though the lessons of Iraq had not been learned.
I know it's incredibly crude, but, you know, you say if more than a certain number of people were killed. I mean, do you mean it has to be measured in thousands, say, rather than hundreds? Or, you know, how do we decide
I've devoted my life to trying to make sure no lives are lost unnecessarily in humanitarian disasters. So any life is too many. But, you know, we've got to be realistic. I mean, as we speak, more lives have been lost in Cote d'Ivoire, a country where a legitimate president is holed up in a hotel, the man who was elected, while his predecessor won't give up office and is mowing down his rival's supporters. We've been through losses in hundreds of thousands and in some cases millions of lives in the civil wars, first in Sudan and then Congo, and there was no outside intervention. So, you know, we're very selective about these things. If it catches the imagination of cable television and our front pages, then there's a huge stir in the House of Commons and the government is it's demanded it does something. And, you know, often by rushing into it, we get it wrong. I mean, we hate what's going on, but if we've learned one thing about democratic change in the world, it is that the main demand for it and the strain of achieving it needs to come from the people of a country themselves. There isn't a kind of shortcut where we come in and impose it through a no-fly zone. So, you know, while we've got to do everything we can to stop the violence, we've also got to be kind of prudent about this and not do something which causes more harm than good.
And Simon, you've been even more anti-gung-ho, if that's the phrase, haven't you, saying that it's a no-fly zone would be tantamount to war?
Well, that's a technical matter. I'm afraid I don't disagree with anything that's been said so far. I don't know as much as Ian about it, and I share Mark's view on the whole, or his scepticism. I think that the partiality or the relativism of the ethical approach to these things is so blatant now. I mean, Ivory Coast, all these other countries, we don't even think about getting involved in them. We would just simply say it's not our business. What's so funny about Libya? The answer is oil, or it's the Mediterranean. But I mean, either way, there are reasons which not only actually play on our consciousness, I think, but also play on the consciousness of those people who'd be criticizing us for doing it. I just think that this Libyan civil war is simply not our business. Too core, end of discussion. I don't know what our responsibility to protect the lesser tribes of Libya is. I don't know what our responsibility to protect any of these people is. If ever there was a cock and bull concept got together by international lawyers, frankly, to give themselves something to do, that was responsibility to protect. And the phrase that was used of hiding behind the concept of national sovereignty, what are you hiding behind? We'd be furious if someone interfered in our national sovereignty. We wouldn't be talking about hiding behind it. We'd regard it as the absolute cardinal basis of national statehood. It underpinned the United Nations too, I may say.
This was an idea that grew up over 10 or 15 years after situations like Rwanda, wasn't it? I mean, it's not quite fair to say, well, we wouldn't like it very much if troops turned up here. And there isn't mass slaughter going on here. And it's a concept, is it not, to deal with that sort of situation?
It is. And, you know, I think Simon, of course, has finally found something we can disagree on. Because I do think, you know, he's overstating the case to the extreme. I mean, the thing about it is one, it was a response to these literal genocides against their own citizens by governments. The rules that prescribe and describe it are, you know, very, very clear. This is not countries that lock up a handful of political prisoners, abhorrent though that may be. It's countries which embark on the wholesale slaughter or harm to their citizens, and whether then, you know, it needs to stop. And, you know, the methods called upon to stop it are only as a last resort military in character. There's a whole effort to get mediation in there, everything else. And, you know, actually, an early concept of the doctrine before we had a title for it was Bill Clinton gently imposing himself on the Irish negotiations. You know, Britain was pretty kind of edgy about that at the beginning, but it needed a third party to come in and help head that off from being a much more protracted war than it was. So I think every country can help from occasionally being reminded it's part of a bigger international community and, you know, part of a bigger value system than just itself.
Ian, focusing back in for a moment on Libya, there have been voices, and I'm thinking of former Foreign Secretary David Owen for one, who've said that there are things that can and should be done in this context at this time. Do you think there's any merit at all in the people who are making that kind of case?
Yes, I think absolutely. There's a case for people trying to alleviate a difficult situation. And as Mark pointed out, we saw a couple of weeks back the UN Security Council, which is always quite difficult to get it to do very much. It's extraordinarily rare for it to act with unanimity, but act with unanimity it actually did. All 15 members of the council, including the five often fractious and divided permanent members, agreed on a package of measures in response to the Libyan crisis. They agreed on those sanctions and assets freezes and travel bans and so on and so forth. What they didn't agree, very conspicuously, was to impose a no-fly zone, which is the subject that's being discussed at the moment by NATO and the EU.
Should they have done?
Well, I think that if you can't do it with the unanimity required by the Security Council, the answer has to be no, precisely because of the shadows that hang over this of Iraq, where a group of countries acted alone without the requisite legal authority and partially because of that created an enormous mess whose consequences are still with us. But that doesn't mean to say that the UN could do nothing. Those people who do believe in this idea of an international community and in an institution to express its will want to see some kind of response to these things precisely because of the memory, not 60 years ago, not under the Nazis, but in when I was a bit younger in the mid-1990s when people died in their hundreds of thousands in Rwanda, where there was indeed no strategic interest for much of the outside world, and to stop things like that happening again. So yes, there should be some kind of international response, but it has to be international. And it particularly, I think, taken the Middle East, taken the sensitivities and the history and the oil and the colonial past, it has to involve the people of that region as well. And I think it would be interesting to talk a little bit more about what they would like to see and not to focus on these Western-dominated institutions that gather every so often in Brussels in response to a crisis.
But what about, you know, Simon's point about the arbitrary way in which the frenzy gets whipped up about we need to have something done in, say, Libya, whereas not in Cote d'Ivoire, where more people may have killed. Is there a reason why Libya is a strong candidate for intervention?
Well, I'm not sure that it is a strong candidate for intervention, but something is going on there at the moment which has engaged the attention of the world. And of course, there's a degree of self-interest. It would be foolish to deny it. Libya is important because of where it is, because of the oil that it has, in a way that Cote d'Ivoire evidently isn't. But, you know, it's one of those situations, is it not, where the best might be the enemy of the good. And if it is possible to do something on the basis of a coalition of international interests for reasons that are a mixture, perhaps, of calculation and altruism, then why not do it?
Well,
Tom Jenkins.
If we adopt what I would regard as a situational ethic to these things, I have no quarrel with that. If that was the way we made it, so to speak, explicit. In the old days, dare we use that phrase, there were fairly clear rules for intervention. You intervened when someone had invaded some other country. I was in favour of the Kuwait War because it was outrageous. I was in favour of the Falklands War, for that matter. These seem to be absolutely clear-cut cases of sovereignty being infringed by a foreign power. Whether they were democracies or dictatorships didn't matter at all. There was a clear rule, and this rule had been broken. Second category, which Marx mentioned, is what might be called mass genocide, where your sensibility is so outraged by what's happening that provided you can do something about it, you do something. But now we've got these other concepts like responsibility to protect. I remember the New York Times producing a wonderful concept that any country that behaves badly towards its people sacrifices any right to sovereignty or integrity. You can't base a foreign policy on that. You can lurch right over to Ian's position and simply say, listen, we got an interest, we're going in. There's a kind of Dick Cheney, Bush approach to war, which at least is clear cut, and we know where we are. But in a case like this, I just think you've got to be very careful. You've got to be careful not just because what you do is probably going to be counterproductive. It almost always is. Look at Lebanon. But even if it's not counterproductive, you are setting a standard for intervention, which will be used against us whenever there's trouble like this and whenever we want to try and influence events.
I'll come to you in a second, Mark. But first of all, Ian, you've just looked like you want a chance to answer back.
All I wanted to say was
identified with Dick Cheney.
Yeah, I mean, Simon, you're eliding things, I think, slightly unfairly. I'm not talking about going in and bombing and responding in a knee-jerk sense. I'm talking about building on what has been achieved, agreed. Again, this extraordinary unanimity by the UN with a recognition that here is an issue that should be addressed. But that's not quite the same
thing. UN always agrees about economic sanctions because they're completely useless, if not counterproductive. And that's not a surprise. What I'd ask you is, do you want to see Saddam go? You're doing this because you want to see him go. Well, presumably, if you want to see him go, you want to see him go. You don't do something that isn't going to get rid of him.
Gaddafi.
Gaddafi,
sorry. Yeah.
But look, I mean, I think it's in a sense, he will go. I think it's very hard to imagine that he can in any long-term way re-establish his position. Not only because, in a sense, he's now ruling a divided country, which is unlikely to go back into its box very easily, but he's managed to, get most of the region to come out of their normal caution about condemning him and condemn him. So he's been suspended from the Arab League. I think the Arab League is much more interested in a no-fly zone than many people might imagine, because it's wondering what it can do, which is a bit more muscular, which might help push him out. And certainly the Western countries, I mean, Britain has oil companies which will want to start getting their oil rolling again after this. So I think for all kinds of reasons, the sands are running out for Colonel Gaddafi. And so, the issue is it a gradual process of attrition and economic pressure where his regime disintegrates and he's finally isolated and toppled? Or is it some much quicker sort of military act? And I think that is fraught with difficulty. It risks being cast as not legitimate. And the first, as I say, is likely to carry the whole international community with it. And my point is, if it's not enough and you have to recalibrate towards tougher, more robust methods, I actually think on this occasion the UN Security Council probably would in due course be game for it.
If that is the case, I mean, if for the sake of the argument we impose a no-fly zone because we're asked to do so, in my experience almost everyone that's losing a war asks for intervention, and we then won. If it doesn't work, we're in a real problem, because you just got to go on and like in Kosovo. And Kosovo was supposed to be entirely no-fly zone, and that was illegal too. But in this case, let's assume for the sake of the argument that we win. We've established a principle that where the civil war breaks out against an undemocratic regime, presumably undemocratic regime, may just be a separatist group, but we have done it before. We will be required, expected, legitimized to do it again. It really is a Pandora's box.
Well, I think that's why the UN Security Council's endorsement for it is so critical. I mean, there are governments, who have a say in there, who are not democracies themselves, who are very prickly about national sovereignty, China most strikingly amongst the group. And so, were they to permission a no-fly zone, it would be as an ultimate resort, and they would do it in a way conditioned to prevent exactly that precedent being drawn. But equally, it's why one has to wait for that, because you don't want to open the Pandora's box.
Are you happy with that, Simon? If there was agreement at the UN Security Council some way down the line, or would you still be worried?
Well, if the Royal Air Force and the US Air Force are operating as agents of the United Nations in effectively achieving a regime change in Libya, I mean, there's no point in doing it if you're not going to win. You want to achieve regime change in Libya under the instructions of the United Nations with its agreement, by definition. I've got no quarrel with that. I mean, I think I wouldn't veto it.
Well, that's an important recognition of a principle. Can I just point the discussion in a slightly different direction? Because I think that this is all very, very important and interesting too. But what if, and I think this is possible, what if Gaddafi wins? What if the expectations that have been attached to this prove to be incorrect? What if, by a combination of timing and ruthlessness and cunning and international divisions and the weakness of his opponents, Gaddafi manages to find himself in a week or a month or a few months in a position akin to Saddam Hussein at the end of the Gulf War in 1991, when the nerve of the international community that you supported, Simon, I remember at the time you saying, the nerve of the international community ran out when it came to the question of whether the liberation of Kuwait would be followed by the overthrow of the tyrant in Baghdad. And maybe Gaddafi is about to do a Saddam. That'll leave everybody in a very difficult situation. First of all, of course, the rebels who have taken up arms against the regime and can expect, I would have thought, a pretty unpleasant retribution if that happens.
Well, I mean, let's just get the parallel right. I mean, I follow you on these things. Parallels are so dangerous in these countries because these countries are so different. But the nerve of the international community didn't run out in the Kuwait war. The remit ended.
It stopped at the border.
It stopped at the border.
Right.
I thought the international community behaved rather honourably in those circumstances. There was considerable pressure to go on to Baghdad. Everybody said no. Not everybody, but most people said no. Shvartsov certainly did. And that was the end of the UN remit. Now, what happened next, as you say, was that we had a no-fly zone to protect the Kurds. I would have thought the parallel at that point does become quite close.
Zone back in on London and Washington for a minute, because you'll have heard that round the table there's a degree of consensus, at least that it's important to be cautious and it's better to do things with the UN than not. But if you've been following statements coming out of the American and British capitals in recent weeks, you'd be forgiven for being a tad confused about what they wanted to happen, or still more, what they were planning to do.
You asked me earlier on about whether Colonel Gaddafi is in Venezuela. I have no information that says he is, although I've seen some information that suggests he is on his way there.
The Libyan regime is using appalling levels of force and violence against its own people, including using aeroplanes that are shooting at people. It is totally unacceptable.
We will continue to send a clear message. The violence must stop. Muammar Gaddafi has lost legitimacy to lead, and he must leave. Those who perpetrate violence against the Libyan people will be held accountable.
We are also agreed that the international community, including the United States and our other partners, should continue to plan for different contingencies, including a no-fly zone, to ensure that we can respond swiftly and resolutely to events in Libya.
The reality is, and people, there's a lot of, frankly, loose talk about some of these military options, and let's just call a spade a spade. A no-fly zone begins with an attack on Libya.
Last week, I authorized the dispatch of a small British diplomatic team to eastern Libya in uncertain circumstances which we judge required their protection, to build on these initial contacts and to assess the scope for closer diplomatic dialogue. I pay tribute to that team. They were withdrawn yesterday after a serious misunderstanding about their role, leading to their temporary detention.
I do say to him there is increasing concern about the government's competence on the issue of Libya. We've had the flights fiasco. We've had talk of Colonel Gaddafi heading to Venezuela when he wasn't. We've had overblown briefing about potential military action, and we had the setback last weekend. Mr. Speaker, does the Prime Minister think it's just a problem with the Foreign Secretary, or is it a wider problem in his government?
I'm not sure I particularly want to take a lecture from Labour about dealing with Gaddafi and dealing with Libya.
Lord Malik Brown, you've been in the Foreign Office yourself. Your old department hasn't covered itself in glory, it's probably fair to say, in the last few weeks.
I think that, well, look, I mean, I think first, there isn't a Foreign Office in the world which predicted these events. And, you know, the Foreign Office is not in the business of flying people out of harm's way. It's consular capability to the moment like that. Don't run further than calling up and renting an aircraft. So I think in some ways, some of what it's gotten smacked around for on this is probably a bit
the diplomatic mission of spies and soldiers.
Well, I think that was a particularly ridiculous thing. I mean, and again, you know, here there were lots of British consular officials already in the town doing the evacuation who'd come perfectly sensibly off a boat. And the diplomats could have entered Benghazi in exactly the same way. So there was a huge misjudgment. Again, you know, whether it was the Foreign Office or whether it was the military security with them, I don't know. So, I don't think it's been the egregious performance that it's been criticised as in the press, which in turn has prompted the Prime Minister and the Foreign Secretary at the dispatch box in the House of Commons to threaten all kinds of things against Libya as a means of kind of righting that.
Yeah.
But not egregious, but definitely not their finest hour.
And do you think it does, I mean, things like that mission and then the flapping about, does it reflect an intellectual confusion in the coalition government in that there's a Tory itch to intervene, but there's also a very Tory tradition of splendid isolation, and they seem to be flipping between the two, don't they?
Well, I think they are. I mean, I think in a way British foreign policy has always veered between the two models represented by Gladstone and Disraeli, and I actually was rather pleased to have a period of Disraelian foreign policy which was less about sending off the gunboats and more about focusing on real national interests and trade. And unfortunately they seem for now to have been bumped off that into something which is more Gladstonian or more Blairite, if you like, with a kind of liberal interventionist twinge or tone to it. And my view as a multilateralist is, the most efficient conduct of a foreign policy is if you, at the national level, in terms of your own bilateral relations, remain quite rigorous around, interests and commercial stuff and all that. And, use vehicles like the UN and to some extent the EU to carry those bigger messages of how it's enormously important that countries like Libya conduct themselves in a way that comports with international values of democracy and human rights, but not to sort of lard your own performance with all of that, as I fear has happened in the last week or so.
And do you think, Simon, that this is a change from Cameron, the level-headed chap who was going to focus pretty hard-headedly on British interests?
I was very puzzled by it. I mean, the aborted expedition was one of the things that happens when the SAS get too enthusiastic. I feel almost sorry for Haig on that one. But on the substance of it, it is quite curious. I mean, I just felt in Cameron's private office a lack of touch. A lack of experience. I mean, you kind of feel that he needed someone who was sort of over 65, who'd been there before and could say, this is how it tends to pan out, so be very careful what you say. I mean, make sure the Americans are on board, make sure you've covered your UN base. I mean, all the simple things you do in diplomacy before you rush out with a belligerent statement. I mean, none of that caution seemed to be there. I'm afraid a bit of it, I think, is that everybody is obsessed with the Falklands. In other words, things are not going too well. Go fight a war. It's great when you can. I mean, John Major.
It's great 1 year before an election, but not.
Anyway, I mean, it's the great salve. I mean, John Major, went to the Kuwait War as soon as he got into office back in 92. And he went out there at once with his cardigan. it did him wonders. And I think they just all want to dust themselves with a bit of glory. And in Cameron's case, I just simply think inexperience was operating.
But the extraordinary thing that this could be seen even as a political option after Iraq. In America, after Vietnam for a generation, and more particularly after Somalia, wasn't it, in the early 90s?
You're just learning about the potency of war language.
I think there's a slightly... I think there's another strand to the explanation of what's going on in this country, and particularly with Cameron. And the fact is, in the context of the wider world and Libya, Britain has been not backward in coming forward in creating a very, very intimate and extremely lucrative relationship with a country that, after all, until very recently was a pariah for almost a decade after the Lockerbie bombing that it is widely believed, certainly by me, that the Libyans were responsible for. Libya was out in the cold for good reason. There was evidence that it had carried out a major act of terrorism. There was a demand that the suspects be handed over, and they were eventually. And the Lockerbie bombing suspects were handed over. Libya, after the war in Iraq, surrendered its albeit pretty rickety arsenal of weapons of mass destruction in order to avoid the fate of what had happened to Saddam in Baghdad. And then, under Tony Blair, 2004, a relationship was forged with Libya as if it were, you know, not that different from Switzerland. Well, it was very different from Switzerland. And the deal was that Libya had cleaned up its act, its very bad act, internationally. It stopped supporting terrorism and it stopped trying to make biological weapons and so on, and had become a respectable member of the international community. But what happened internally in Libya, the repression, all those things, were left untouched. And that mismatch between its external position and the internal one, I think after the Tunisian, the Egyptian events, after Cameron's embarrassingly timed arms sales mission to the Gulf, while we're promoting Arab democracy, I think that there has been an overreaction to the Libyan case. And that must account to some extent for his, one has to say, intemperate and slightly bizarre remarks in the context of what everybody else is doing and what is likely to happen.
It's been some time since people have thought that London could reshape the world on its own, and the hope has been, on the Labour side in particular, that Europe might give it a way to do it. But today we have Germany and Britain, I think, writing to Cathy Ashton, the British European High Representative on Foreign Affairs, asking her to make some kind of declaration or give some kind of statement about how Gaddafi should go. I mean, this is words about words, isn't it? I mean, that's really not
Yeah, I don't think the EU is putting on a particularly impressive performance in all of this. And, you know, I think it's an extraordinary thing because there was such a debate about this treaty, and one of its main features was to create this European Action Service and get some real kind of policy leadership for it with a formidable figure at its head. And, you know, I don't know quite where the turn in the road came, but for whatever reason, we've ended up with a kind of minnow of a service, not in its cost, but in its impact on this crisis, but crises like Haiti before it.
Well, we're going to have to leave that there for this week. You can follow The Guardian's extensive coverage and the unfolding events in the Middle East at guardian.co.uk/world. Now, there's an address. My thanks to Simon Jenkins, Ian Black, and to Mark Mallett-Brown, whose book, The Unfinished Global Revolution, is out now. The producer was Phil Maynard. I'm Tom Clark. Thanks very much, and goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.